12. I was a bit surprised when he appeared for the first class I took at the typing school. He did not look anything like a typing teacher. For one thing, for no good reason perhaps, I had it in my head that typing teachers were always women. Women of a certain age, with an overly polite way of speaking, heavy makeup, and bony fingers. But I found instead a very young man. One of average build, dressed in well-cut clothing in understated colors. He was not particularly handsome in a classical sense, but each feature, eyelids, eyebrows, lips, jaw, made a strong impression. His expression was calm and thoughtful, but tinged with a distinct shadow, something you would notice if you focused solely on his eyebrows, for example. He looked like a law professor or a preacher. Perhaps rightly so, since we were in a church. Or an industrial engineer. But he was, in fact, a typing teacher. One who knew just about everything there was to know about typing. I never once saw him actually using a typewriter, though. He merely circulated among the students, commenting on the position of our fingers, or the way we handled the machine, and then marking the mistakes on our practice sheets with a red pen. From time to time, we were tested on the number of words we could type in a given period of time. He would stand in front of the classroom and take a stopwatch from his jacket pocket. We would wait for his signal, fingers poised over the keys, sample text next to the typewriter. I was fairly certain that he had composed the English words on the pages we were to copy, which were usually letters or occasionally something that looked like a thesis of some sort. These tests were not my greatest strength. Even for words I had been able to type quite easily during practice, when it came to the test, my fingers suddenly seemed to freeze. I would reverse the letters G and H, or confuse B and V. Or, in the worst cases, miss the starting position for my fingers completely and end up typing nonsense. I was particularly susceptible to that distinct variety of calm that comes before the start of a test. Those few seconds when everyone held his or her breath, when the sounds of prayers and organ music from the church had died away and our senses were concentrated in our fingers. Those seconds completely unnerved me. I was convinced that the calm in the room would assume an almost physical form, like a gas leaking from the stopwatch he held in his hand. The watch was apparently well used, and its thin silver chain was tarnished. The thumb of his right hand would be poised on the button, which he was about to push at any moment. The chain would be draped across his chest. The gaseous calm, emanating from his hand, crept along the floor of the classroom, accumulating in the corners and eventually coming to rest on my hands. It felt chilly and oppressive. I had the feeling that the least movement of my fingers would rend the membrane of silence and everything would fall to pieces. And my heart would begin to pound. At the instant my suffering was reaching a peak, when I was unable to stand even another second, he would give the signal to start. His timing was always impeccable, as though the stopwatch had been measuring my heartbeat.
"Begin!"
It was the loudest thing he said in the classroom. Then every typewriter would begin clicking away, except mine, which remained frozen as though terrified. For a long time, I have wanted to watch him in the act of typing. It must be very beautiful to see. The glittering, carefully maintained machine, the snow-white paper, his perfectly straight back, his expertly placed fingers. The very thought of it makes me sigh. But I've never yet seen him type, even now that we have become lovers. He never types in front of other people. It happened about 3 months after I'd started attending the typing classes. A heavy snow had fallen that day, the most I'd ever seen. The buses and trains were stopped, and the whole town was buried. I left the house early, walking to the church in order to be on time for a 3 o'clock class. On the way, I fell several times, and the cloth bag I used to carry my books had gotten wet. Even the top of the steeple was covered in snow. In the end, I was the only one who made it to class that day.
"It's good of you to have come in such weather," he said.
As usual, his clothes were perfectly pressed, without a stain or wet spot from the snow.
"I thought no one would show up."
"If I skip a single day, my fingers get stiff," I told him, taking my textbook out of the damp bag. It was particularly quiet that day, perhaps because of the snow. I sat down at the fourth typewriter from the window. We had a rule that the first to arrive could choose any machine she wanted, since each had its idiosyncrasies, sticky keys, or worn-out letters. Usually he would sit at his desk near the blackboard, but that day he stood near me. First, I typed a business letter, a request for an advance copy of an instruction manual for a recently imported machine for manufacturing jam. He stared at my hands the whole time I typed. As soon as my eyes strayed the least bit from the text, some portion of him appeared in my field of vision. Shoes, pants, belt, cufflinks. It's difficult to type a letter, with all the rules concerning the line spacing and layout. I'd always had trouble, even under normal circumstances, but with the teacher observing me so closely, I grew more and more tense and made one mistake after another. Nor did he miss a single one of them. He would bend over, bringing his face close to the typewriter, and point to each error. It wasn't done in the spirit of reproach, but nevertheless, I felt increasingly oppressed, as though I were being backed into a corner by a powerful force.
"You need to press harder with the middle finger of your left hand. That's why the top of the E is always missing."
After pointing out the faulty E, he took hold of my finger.
"None of your other fingers are bent this way at the tip."
"No, that's right. I jammed this one playing basketball when I was a little girl." I could tell that my voice sounded a bit hoarse.
"It will work better if you strike the key straight down," he said,
holding my finger and tapping several times as he pulled up on the curved joint. E, 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 E. He had taken hold of the barest tip of my finger, but I was as overwhelmed as if he had taken me in his arms. His hand was cold and hard. I don't believe that he held me with unusual force, but I felt an inescapable sense of oppression, as though the skin of his hand had attached itself to my finger, which continued to tap at the key. His shoulder, his elbow, and hip were just there, next to me. He seemed to have no intention of releasing my finger, which continued to tap at the key. E, 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 E. The tapping of the key striking the paper was the only sound in the room. Snow had begun to fall again, covering the tracks I had made between the gate of the church and the clock tower. He continued to hold me tighter and tighter. The stopwatch slipped from his breast pocket, turning over once in the air as it fell to the floor. I wondered whether it had broken. It seemed strange that I would be preoccupied with the stopwatch when I should have been worrying about what he was trying to do to me. The bell in the clock tower began to chime. 5 o'clock. The vibration came from far above, rattling the window glass and passing through our bodies before being absorbed by the snow below. The only motion was the falling of the snowflakes. I held my breath, unable to move, as though locked inside the typewriter. From that point on, I decided to have R read my manuscript before showing it to the new editor. Needless to say, he could no longer write comments in the margins, but we discussed every detail of the work as we always had, there in the secret room. Since there was just one chair, we would sit next to each other on the bed, using the back cover of a sketchbook as a makeshift table for the manuscript. It was better for him, too, to have work to do. The healthiest way of living in the secret room was to wake in the morning thinking about the things that had to be done during the day. Then, at night before going to bed, to check that everything had been accomplished, whether satisfactorily or not. Moreover, the morning agenda needed to be as concrete as possible, and the tasks ideally involved some sort of reward, no matter how small. Finally, the day's work needed to tire him out in both body and spirit.
"If it wouldn't be too much trouble," R began rather guardedly one evening as he received his dinner tray halfway up the ladder. "Would you mind finding me some sort of work to do? I'd like to contribute what I can. And besides, it would help me pass the time."
"You mean something other than reading my novel?" I looked down at him through the trapdoor.
"I do. I know I can't be very useful working here in this room, but any sort of trivial task will do. It may be difficult for you to find something, but I'd be truly grateful. I feel so useless."
He held the tray in both hands and looked down at the food arranged on it. As he spoke, little ripples ran across the surface of the potato soup. "It won't be difficult at all. I have all kinds of little chores. By tomorrow morning, I'll find something. It's an excellent idea, killing two creatures with one stone. So eat your dinner while it's still warm. I'm sorry that it's the same soup day after day, but the harvest was terrible this year, and there are no vegetables other than last year's potatoes and onions."
"Not at all. It's delicious."
"That's the first time anyone has ever complimented my cooking. Thank you."
"And my thanks to you for finding me something to do."
"Not at all. Good night, then."
"Until tomorrow."
Standing on the narrow ladder, his hands encumbered by the tray, R simply nodded his goodbye. Once I was sure he had reached the floor, I closed the trap door. Thus it was that supplying him with work came to be added to my daily tasks. They were all simple jobs: organizing receipts, sharpening pencils, recopying my address book, putting page numbers on my manuscripts. But he eagerly took them all on, and by the next morning, everything had been finished in the most precise manner possible. In this way, we managed to live in relative security. Everything went according to plan, and we seemed to have solutions for any problems that did occur. The old man did much to help us, and R did his best to adjust quickly to the secret room. But quite apart from the small satisfactions we enjoyed, the world outside was deteriorating day by day. The disappearances, which had slowed down after the roses, returned with two in quick succession. First, photographs, and then fruits of all sorts. As I was gathering all the albums and photos in the house, including the portrait of my mother on the mantelpiece, to burn them in the garden incinerator, R made a desperate effort to stop me.
"Photographs are precious. They preserve memories. If you burn them, there's no getting them back. You mustn't do this, absolutely not."
"But what can I do? The time has come for them to disappear," I told him.
"If their photographs are gone, how will you remember your parents' faces?"
he asked, looking deeply troubled. "It's their photographs that will disappear, not my mother and father," I said. "I'll never forget their faces. They may be nothing more than scraps of paper, but they capture something profound. Light and wind and air, the tenderness or joy of the photographer, the bashfulness or pleasure of the subject. You have to guard these things forever in your heart. That's why photographs are taken in the first place." "Yes, I know. And that's why I've always been very careful with them. They brought back wonderful memories every time I looked at them. Memories that made my heart ache. As I wander through my sparse forest of memories, photographs have been my most reliable compass. But it's time to move on. It's terrible to lose a compass, but I have no strength to resist the disappearances." "But even if you can't resist them, you don't have to burn your photographs. Important things remain important things, no matter how much the world changes," said R. "Their essence doesn't change. If you keep them, they're bound to bring you something in return. I don't want to see any more of your memories lost." "No," I said, shaking my head wearily. "Nothing comes back now when I see a photograph. No memories. No response. They're nothing more than pieces of paper. A new hole has opened in my heart, and there's no way to fill it up again. That's how it is when something disappears, though I suppose you can't understand." He looked down, his eyes sad. "The new cavities in my heart search for things to burn. They drive me to burn things, and I can stop only when everything is in ashes. Why would I keep them when I don't think I will be able to recall the meaning of the word photograph much longer? Not to mention the danger if the memory police find them. They're even more vigilant after a disappearance, and if they suspect me, that will put you in danger." He said nothing more. Taking off his glasses, he pressed his fingers to his temples and heaved a deep sigh. I took the paper bag full of photographs that I'd been holding to the incinerator at the back of the garden. The disappearance of fruit was much simpler. When we woke in the morning, fruit of every sort was falling from trees all over the island. A pattering sound could be heard everywhere. And in the northern hills and the forest park, fruit came down like a hailstorm. Some were as big as baseballs, some small as beans, some covered in shells, some brightly colored. Fruits of all kinds. Though the morning was perfectly still, fruit fell from the branches one after the other. They fell on your head if you walked outdoors, and if you failed to watch your step, you trampled them underfoot. Then, before long, the snow began to fall, covering all the fruit.